Special podcast alert. This is a literature podcast. Hi, everybody. It's Todd Conklin. Welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm so glad you're here. This one's going to be an interesting podcast. Let's just jump right into it. There's really no reason to hesitate about this. I want to get this out in the open, out front. So if you want to listen, you can. If you don't want to listen, that's fine, too. Although I would tell you, you probably should at least listen a bit because I think you're going to find this podcast very interesting. You know, I have this kind of thing, this bugaboo. Oh, can I say bugaboo? I don't know if I can say that. I have this thing, let's call it a thing, where I just don't think people read very much, and it bugs the crap out of me. Now, a lot of you guys, I know you read, so this isn't for you. And if you don't read very much, I'm sure you have compelling reasons why you don't. But it doesn't hurt for you to be introduced to some interesting things. And today's a really interesting day because I'm about to present to you one of my favorite authors and one of my very favorite books. Now, the author is named Hampton Sides, and the book is called Blood and Thunder. And many of you have read it because, well, quite honestly, I browbeat you into reading it. So I know some of you have read it. I had the best afternoon today, and I want to share it with you. And I got permission from Hampton Sides to do this. He's going to talk about a book he wrote 10 years ago. Now, it's the 100th anniversary of the national parks. And so I don't know about your local national park, but where I live, there's a whole bunch of them, and they're all doing all these special things. And one of the things that's happening at a park called the Pecos National Monument, which is a really, really interesting park right outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, actually near Glorieta, which was the site of a very famous Civil War battlefield, the Glorieta battlefield. The Pecos National Monument is doing an author series, and they do it every third Sunday. And so today I went, and I thought I'm going to record it because why wouldn't I? I mean, if anything else, it's a Father's Day gift for my father, but it's also an incredible way to sort of share with you some of the world that's out there around us and some of the really interesting things that are going on. Now, this book, Blood and Thunder, is about really the westward expansion of the United States, which happened very quickly and is an incredibly interesting story. And it's about a specific character who's rather famous. Well, maybe I should say infamously famous, if I can say that. I can't even say it, right? He's famous, but he's famous for lots of reasons, some good and some not so good. And that character's name was Kit Carson. You might know about him. Well, Hampton Sides wrote a book that I think is about, well, it reads like a nice cup of hot chocolate. It's the smoothest read. You about can't put it down, which is really true of almost all his books. And he writes about all sorts of interesting things. I mean, his most recent book that I've read was on Antarctica, but I mean, he's got a whole bunch of other stuff that's it's just out there, and it's so interesting. I asked Hampton if I could tape this and share it with you guys. So I'll just say right now, some of you are going to listen and really enjoy this, and some of you may fast forward through this, and that's okay as well. Either way, this is a great chance to sort of show you this piece of literature, and I'm pretty excited about it. And maybe if I really do my job well, you'll pick it up. You'll download it to your Kindle or your iPad, and you'll jam your way through it. Either way, let's spend the next, 36 minutes or so and listen to an author talk about his book. This is Hampton Sides and his discussion of a book called Blood and Thunder.
I'm just going to jump right in because I know that some of you are probably going to die of heat exhaustion if I don't just start. Wow, I am so impressed with this turnout here on a really, really, really hot day. That's Father's Day, no less, to come here about this book and how I wrote it. And I can't believe it's been 10 years since I wrote Blood and Thunder. It seems like just yesterday when I was researching this book here in this place and a lot of other parks around the country, kind of following in the footsteps of Kit Carson. How many of you have read Blood and Thunder?
This is great.
Well, this whole PowerPoint slideshow is not even necessary. So, you know, Blood and Thunder is not exactly a biography. It uses the life and times of Kit Carson as a kind of through line, as a sort of connective tissue to take you through a lot of the story of the American conquest of the West. But what's interesting and fascinating and almost difficult to believe, it's incredible that one man's life could intersect with history in so many ways, repeatedly. Carson was always there whenever it seems like anything was happening in the American West. And if he wasn't there, it was one degree of separation. His best friend was there, his wife was there. So he provided this unbelievable through line, kind of like a Forrest Gump character or a Zelig character, to pull you through all of this history. And you know, that all of this happened in one man's life. That the entire western third of the continent was captured and conquered in one generation. And that one man played such a kind of pivotal role in so many different ways, often unwittingly. Often Carson doesn't seem to be fully aware of what he's doing or the larger consequences of what he's doing. Just a little bit of background about me. I never thought I would write a Western. I'm not originally from the West. I grew up, was born and raised in Memphis. I was kind of vaguely nervous around horses. Never really liked cowboy and Indian, you know, shoot 'em ups, John Wayne pictures. It really wasn't my scene. But I did have an interesting early encounter with a great narrative historian. The very first writer I ever met growing up in Memphis was the great Civil War historian Shelby Foote. His son and I were good friends. We were in a rock band together. And we did everything we could to prevent Shelby from writing that amazing trilogy of the Civil War, cranking up the Hendrix and Pink Floyd and that sort of thing. But he gave me some really interesting ideas early on about what narrative history can be, what it can aspire to be, what it should be, and it really set me on this career trajectory. I moved out to Santa Fe 22 years ago to work for a magazine called Outside, which is based here, and I was working with a lot of great writers like John Krakauer and Sebastian Younger and Tim Cahill and a lot of really amazing writers. Learned a lot from these folks, but then at a certain point, my wife and I made a decision. This is where we're going to live. We love this place. We fell in love with the Southwest, and I was looking for a story that would really sink my teeth into the history and the lore, the topography, and, you know, just the entire sweep of the American West. And I was in Canyon de Chelly in Navajo country in Arizona, and I heard the story about the Long Walk of the Navajo, the conquest of the Navajo, from a Navajo guide. And he, of course, as you know, the Navajo do not particularly like Kit Carson. When he told me the story, you know, I was trying to reconcile this story with what little I remembered from growing up about Kit Carson being kind of a folk hero, the subject of these juvenile biographies that I had read, and the real sort of contrast between what he was saying about Kit Carson and what I remembered is what initially propelled me into this story. It's like, wait a minute, who was this guy, Kit Carson? I kind of had this feeling that he was kind of a made-up guy, like he was a fictional character, because he was, of course, a fictional character, the subject of all these Blood and Thunder books, early Westerns, pulp novels, B-movies, cartoons, all kinds of comic books. And so separating sort of the fictitious character of Kit Carson from the real guy was my task for the 5 years that I worked on this book. So Carson came out here on the Santa Fe Trail, which, of course, goes right by here. He was a runaway from Missouri, born in Kentucky, raised in Missouri. His father died when Carson was 8 years old, and he was orphaned, so to speak, or not really orphaned. His mother turned him loose on an apprenticeship that he hated with every fiber of his being, making saddles in a saddle shop in Missouri. And somewhere along the line, he ran into one of these mountain men who told him about the American West and what was going on in the mountains. And he decided then and there that he wanted to run away and never come back. So he came west as a 16-year-old and didn't really like Santa Fe. He actually decided that the place he wanted to be was Taos, because Taos was where the mountain men were. It was the southwestern capital of the fur trade, and there were these greasy, grizzled, smelly, mostly French guys who had this very colorful life that he wanted to be a part of. Scrolling through some of these. yeah, the mountain men. So, you know, who are these guys? Not much to look at, but they had a rare set of skills and talents. They understood the drainages and all the river systems of the West and knew how to get along with most of the Native American tribes and others. They fought endlessly. They were kind of progenitors of Manifest Destiny, well before Manifest Destiny. They were in the West and knew the West and loved the West like no others. They were often on the backs of mules, not horses. They were pursuing this critter. Why were they so interested in beavers? Mainly because in London and in Paris and in New York, it had been decided that a beaver pelt, that a beaver hat, was the best hat you could ever own. And so for about a generation, the beaver trade really was propelled by this fashion. And these men were able to go into the river systems. They're very successful at it, so successful that they led to the near extinction of beaver from certain creeks and rivers in the West as they moved west. Now, Carson kind of came to the party a little late. He was one of the last sort of half generation of mountain men, but he would soon become one of the most famous of all the mountain men. So Carson, this is one of the first photographs we have of him. When he was a mountain man, he became quite famous among that group of guys for an exploit at a rendezvous where he killed a Frenchman named Chouinard, possibly over a rivalry over this girl, Singing Grass, that he eventually married. And this was the love of his life. He was married to her for a number of years. They had two children. She died, unfortunately, in childbirth with their second child. But during those years, he lived, when he wasn't with the mountain men, he was with the Arapaho, her tribe, and he learned their language. And he lived more really like an Arapaho than an Anglo-American. You know, a lot of you will hear that Kit Carson was this great Indian hater, Indian fighter, and that he was this genocidal guy who hated Native Americans, which is absolutely not true. He spoke seven different Indian languages. He was married to Singing Grass, happiest years of his life. He was also briefly married to a Cheyenne woman, you know, lived truly more like an Arapaho than a white guy during these years. The beaver trade began to sort of die out in the 1820s, and I'm just scrolling through a bunch of stuff. But what happened was in Paris and in London and in New York, it was decided suddenly beaver hats, not so great. Silk hats. This is a silk hat. And really the bottom dropped out of the trade. That's an oversimplification of what happened, but a number of other factors led to the dying out of this as a viable business. And so Carson was kind of basically looking for work. He was trying to figure out what to do next after having traveled all over the West and had all these adventures as a mountain man. He briefly worked out at Ben's Fort. I don't know if any of you have been to Ben's Fort. As a hunter hunting buffalo, and spent a number of years hunting for that fort, and was quite successful as a hunter. These guys who were out on the plains were, in fact, too successful and led pretty quickly to the near extinction of the buffalo. So mountain man, then he becomes a hunter. But then he falls in love with this woman, his third and final wife, the wife that he lived with the rest of his life, Josefa Jaramillo from Taos, 18 years his junior, quite a good-looking woman by all accounts. Carson was not exactly the most, you know, he wasn't winning any beauty contests exactly himself, but he must have had some kind of charisma, some kind of something that appealed to her at least. So the other factor, before we kind of get into manifest destiny, that defined life in New Mexico was the Navajo Wars. These wars that had sort of been low-grade wars back and forth between the Navajo and the Spanish, and then the Mexicans, and also the Pueblo Indians, in which basically they stole each other's women and sheep and cattle and horses, and went on raids back and forth. This had been going on for over 300 years. The Navajo country, I don't need to tell you, is a world unto itself. It's unbelievably huge and beautiful and spectral and strange. The Navajo would come on these raids. They'd steal a lot of sheep and cows and horses and sometimes women and children. And the Spanish would retaliate with their own raids. And this had gone on for a long, long time. The Navajo had particularly been successful at stealing the sheep, and particularly churro sheep, and making these unbelievable blankets, which later became Navajo rugs, as we know them today. But all along the Rio Grande, there were these settlements and ranches all the way from, you know, Taos all the way down to Socorro and beyond. And these raids happened along the Rio Grande. And this was a factor of life. It was something that really affected everyone. The Spanish had auction blocks in various towns where they actually, you know, you could buy a Navajo slave from a raid. And this kind of back and forth thing had gone on for a very long time, and was a factor of life that when the Americans arrived, they decided they wanted to somehow resolve. So manifest destiny. Kit Carson certainly never used the word manifest destiny. Far more highfalutin term than he would ever have used. But he was in many ways kind of an agent, sometimes an unwitting agent of manifest destiny in all the different roles that he played. The architect of manifest destiny, if there was one, was this guy, Senator Thomas Hart Benton from Missouri, who had written about this and had given huge speeches and filibusters in the Senate about how we needed to have ports on the Pacific in order to trade with China and India, and in order to become an empire. We needed to, in order to compete with England and France and Spain, we needed to be a continental nation. It was a subject that he never stopped talking about for his whole career. His son-in-law ended up being a very important kind of agent of his ideas. This is John Fremont, who was a cartographer, was a kind of an amateur botanist, extremely ambitious young man who wanted to map the West, and got these assignments, thanks to his father-in-law, to map the Oregon Trail and other parts in the West. He was brilliant, but usually the first to admit it. He was a very arrogant, very egotistical, grandiose guy. But he got these early expeditions to
come west with the topographical core to map the west. And he needed a guide. He needed someone who already knew the west. And he ended up hiring Kit Carson as his guide and scout. And Carson proved to be excellent at this. And when Fremont came home to from his various expeditions to write up his adventures, and with the help of his wife, let's see, I think I have a picture of her, Jesse Benton Fremont, they wrote up these accounts and they became best-selling books, and they actually ignited kind of like a tsunami, a tsunami of immigration, these books really were influential in sending settlers west to Oregon and other parts of the West. And in these books, Carson is depicted as being this you know, plucky guy who can do no wrong. Everywhere he goes, he makes the right decision. He's brave, he's bold, and he becomes a household name. I mean, everyone knows about this Kit Carson because of these books. And this leads in turn to the publication of a number of cartoonish books, which ultimately leads to these Blood and Thunders, they were called. These were kind of precursors to the modern Western. And these Blood and Thunder books, I would dare you to read them. I went to National Archives and read a number of them. They're not great literature, but they're hugely popular, and both in the North and in the South, even as far back, even later in the Civil War times, in the trenches of the Civil War, both the Northerners and Southerners were reading these stories. It's one story everyone could agree on. Carson was usually depicted as like 7 feet tall, blonde, blue-eyed. It would say he would kill 2 Indians before breakfast, which was considered, I guess, a good thing back then. Carson absolutely hated these books. He hated these books because they created a caricature that he really spent the rest of his life trying to live down. They never asked his permission to use his name. They were completely fictitious. And not only that, but Carson hated these books because he couldn't read them because he was illiterate. He spoke these 7 Indian tongues. He spoke Spanish, of course. He spoke French, but he couldn't read. And so he had to have other people read these books to him. Those books, in turn, led to a bunch of like comic books and so many different storylines that finally they ran out of stories, and they had to have like Kit Carson Jr., crack shot of the West. So then comes the Mexican-American War, and this is the time when sort of Manifest Destiny gets ignited in Washington, and it really gets its start with this guy, President James K. Polk, an amazing guy in many ways. He sort of came out of nowhere from Tennessee, dark horse candidate. He only served one term. He said, "I would only serve one term." He said, "We would get all the West in my term." He wanted all of it. He wanted Oregon and what we now call Washington and Oregon from the British. He wanted to buy as much of it from the Mexicans as he could, from Mexico as he could. When that didn't work, he kind of orchestrated a war down in Texas. And anyway, by the time he was done with his term, we had it all. The nation had grown by one third in one term. And then he went home to Tennessee, and in 2 months, he was dead. So he sort of came out of nowhere and vanished. But anyway, he sent this guy, Stephen Watts Kearney, west with what was called the Army of the West from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And they came right by here. In fact, in the book, there's some places where they're camping here right by the ruins of Pecos. They come to Santa Fe and conquer Santa Fe without firing a shot. It's the first sort of foreign conquest by an American army. They raise the American flag on the plaza there in Santa Fe, and then keep going west towards California and conquer California. Along the way, Kearney meets Carson along the Rio Grande and sort of appropriates him, turns him around, and has him be his guide as they work their way across the Southwest all the way to California. They participate in a pretty brutal battle called the Battle of San Pasquale, where Carson proves to be one of the heroes. Kearney is nearly killed in this battle that involved, basically medieval kind of warfare. He was gored by one of these Spanish horsemen. And the Battle of San Pasquale is over. Ultimately, California is conquered. And then you see, basically, the western third of the United States is suddenly American soil. And Carson has played a pivotal role in this whole thing. But then that's not enough. He's lived like four lives so far. Now he's moving into his fifth life in the Civil War, and then ultimately his involvement in the Navajo Wars. Most of you know that Carson was actively involved in the Battle of Valverde down on the Rio Grande. Not here at not in this area here. He wasn't at Glorieta, but was pivotal in the battle at Valverde. I'm skipping through some of this stuff. But after the whole battle here, most of you know there was a large group, an army from Texas that came up from San Antonio. And what they were trying to do was conquer New Mexico, but ultimately they wanted to conquer Colorado so they could get to the oil, the gold fields and, get sort of a reconquest of the West. Then they wanted to move west all the way to California and have ports on the Pacific. So it was almost like a Confederate second version of Manifest Destiny that nearly was successful. But they were stopped at Valverde and then Glorieta, and the Texans were sent back to Texas, where they belong. just kidding. The next chapter happens just after that battle is over. This gentleman, General James Henry Carleton, comes into Santa Fe, and he has big ambitions to really go after the Navajo and to really arrest for the first time successfully that pattern that I was talking about earlier of just raids, endless raids, and just all the heartache and heartbreak that came from slavery and on both sides. And so he had this notion that what we needed to do was to round up the Navajo and teach them sort of at gunpoint overnight to become Christian farmers living in apartment buildings like the Pueblo Indians. And he had a place mapped out on the Pecos River downstream at a place called the Bosque Redondo. And it was a great experiment, kind of a super reservation it was supposed to be kind of an example of how we could treat all the raiding tribes. And he went into it with a lot of ambition and in a certain way, a lot of idealism, but it ended up being a complete mess and on so many different levels. But he hired Kit Carson to lead the fight into Navajo country and to round up the Navajo. Carson immediately tried to resign. He said he had signed up to fight Texans, not Indians. Which is interesting in and of itself, by the way, because most of his brothers, his siblings back in Missouri, were all Confederates. The question of why he chose to be a Union soldier is endlessly debated among the Carson scholars. But nonetheless, he tried to resign from this task, which he was not happy about at all. But Carleton would not let him. He pretty much threatened him. to go in and do this. And so Carson does. He goes into Navajo country. He realizes he cannot fight the Navajo in conventional terms because the Navajo will not meet him in a battlefield situation. And what he has to do is wage war on their land. And he basically, you know, every cornfield, every peach orchard, every salt source, every water source, every sheep, every horse, every cow is slaughtered or destroyed. And it's basically a scorched earth campaign. Just a few months before Sherman leads his more famous scorched earth campaign across the American South, this is all happening during the Civil War. Carson leads this two-year campaign against the Navajo, and ultimately is successful. The Navajo do surrender in large numbers, many of them in Canyon de Chelly, and they go on their famous long walk across New Mexico to the Bosque Redondo, where they try to make this experiment work of becoming Christian farmers living in apartment buildings. The Navajo don't like to live that way. They don't live in concentrated cities. They have a very different kind of society. And it proved to be a tragic experiment. Within 3 years, a third of the tribe had died of disease. There were various insect blights, diseases of all sorts. They were raided constantly by the Comanche, an old enemy of the Navajo. Nearly a half the tribe had died before finally the United States government began to see that this was a huge mistake. Carson had moved on by that point to play other roles. I guess where are we now? His sixth life or seventh life as a sort of an ambassador negotiating all kinds of treaties on behalf of different tribes, especially the Ute tribe, which was one of the tribes he was particularly close to. But he realized that he was dying at this point. He had an aneurysm on his aorta, which it was just sort of growing and growing, and there was great danger of rupturing. It's likely that this was caused by syphilis. It certainly, as I've gone around the country doing my talks, doctors have come up to me and said, you know, that's a classic symptom of syphilis. Certainly the mountain men had syphilis in large numbers. It's possible that that's what caused it. At any rate, he knew that he was dying, and he came east one last time. This is the last photograph that was taken of him. He negotiated a treaty for the Ute Indians, then he made it home to Colorado. This is his last words. It's not true. That's not true. No, but the reason he wanted to get home so badly was that he knew his wife was pregnant with what would have been their eighth child. She unfortunately died shortly after childbirth, and then Carson himself died 1 month later. They're both buried together there in the cemetery in Taos, in Kit Carson Park, which many of you may know as they're trying to change the name of it. Needless to say, Carson's a very controversial person in parts of New Mexico. His grave has been desecrated. He's been compared to Genghis Khan and Hitler and all kinds of other nefarious characters. But he's also a hero and a folk hero and widely loved and admired as well. The legend of Carson continued well after his death with all these comic books, particularly hugely popular in Europe, especially Germany and France. It was a subject of lots of really, really bad TV shows. Let's face it, most of them were pretty bad. There's, you know, evidence of Kit Carson everywhere you go in the West. Kit Carson Peak, Carson National Forest, Fort Carson up in Colorado Springs. I don't know. There's Carson Pass. There's Carson River, Kit Carson County. On and on it goes. He's like a jack in the box. He's everywhere in the West. Carson City, Nevada, the capital of Nevada. So he's everywhere among us, and you can't get away from him. He's bigger than we are. Writing this story, following in his footsteps, me doing it mostly in a Volkswagen diesel Jetta, but thinking about him doing it on the back of a mule, all these trips to, you know, from Oregon to Mexico to, he made a number of trips to Washington, D.C. as a courier, and all the different kind of roles that he played in the West, just makes me realize what an expansive life he lived and what a different time it was. I guess that's sort of the overview of kind of how I wrote the story, why I wrote the story.
Liberal Education Day. There you go. That's an author's talk. That's pretty much what they sound like. I think that was really interesting, but I love this book. I'd be curious if you love it too. He just tells a really good story. Hampton Sides. Check it out. I hope you enjoyed this little chance to kind of hear an author's talk. I do think in our world, the power of the story is everything. And history is always revisited. It's always sort of created after the fact, just like an investigation or a safety program or a safety problem. It's always sort of revisionist in its nature. And that's kind of why I'm drawn to this book. It's so interesting. All his books are, but I think this one's amazingly interesting. I hope you enjoyed today. Hey, thanks for being a part of the podcast. You make this baby go. Without you, I don't know where I'd be. Probably speaking in my closet. That's pretty much what I do. Hope you get to learn something new every single day. Have as much fun as you possibly can. And for goodness sakes, be safe.